Hello and welcome everyone back to another episode of The Publisher Lab. I'm Tyler Bishop, and joined with me today, as you've probably known to expect him, is our good friend producer Manny. And today we're going to be diving into all kinds of interesting stories in the world of publishing. And producer Manny, we've got no shortage of interesting information, both from the likes of our good friends in big tech, who are just inseparable to our space and the things and the subjects that we talk about on the show. And in addition to that, we've got, you know, surprisingly, or I guess not surprisingly, a heap of news in the world of AI. And, you know, the other thing that we were talking about before the show is that, you know, government regulations and sort of like, municipal laws and localities and even different like shifts and changes in global economic trends are starting to influence things maybe more so than they have in the past. So it's interesting to sort of see the wave of things that have been happening. And as we kind of just dive right in today, we have a number of topics. So I figured, you know, you don't need me to complain about the weather here in California, which here in San Diego today, it's a little bit like, we've not really had a summer, have we, producer Manny?
No, it just went from very cloudy to very hot to very cloudy.
And there I go, talking about the weather when I said we were going to dive straight into it. You guys know me. I'll tangent from time to time. But getting into the news of the day, we've got a couple stories up first from, it looks like Google's in the news and they started their first week of the antitrust trial. Isn't that right, producer Manny?
Yes, it is. So in the first week of the antitrust trial against Google, the U.S. Justice Department alleged that Google used its dominance to bully competitors, kind of with the whole default system, and like they're the default browser in Safari. They claim Google made strategic deals with companies like Apple to ensure search engine remains the default choice. Google counters by saying that these deals benefit the consumers. The trial is set to feature some testimonies from high-profile witnesses like Google's CEO. So they're in some hot water, and I'll jump a little bit ahead here because the U.S. is really trying to pin Google as a bully here. So what do you think?
Yeah, no, anytime you can get their CEO Sundar Pichai, if you have him testifying, that means it's a very serious charge. Because it's something that he's not going to want to do that. And his time is valuable, and he's not somebody that's going to get drug into, you know, like just some kind of like slap on the wrist case. This is serious. This is probably the most serious sort of antitrust, potential action that's taken place against Google. And, I think that the case in this particular one, because there's been multiple here recently, and there's multiple ones ongoing. This one primarily focuses on their ad business and how they were able to build such a strong alleged monopoly in that space, which is truly when you look at that case in particular, especially with sort of like the case that we know so far has been built against them. It's the strongest one. So you mentioned them doing deals with the likes of Apple. I think a couple of years ago it was reported they paid them $4 billion a year, maybe up to $12 billion now. I can't remember exactly what it was. It's between 4 and 12. And I think there's like tranches to it. But they're paying Apple in this case, which, you know, Apple's happy to take that money. But these deals were worked out long, long ago. So if you're thinking like, well, it's the money that's this barrier. So Google is, you know, keeping competitors out because they're spending money that others can't. It's not necessarily the case. Microsoft has that money and would have probably gladly paid Apple for the same deal. The difference is time. So Google, what's alleged here and what makes a strong case is that they knowingly built this. So if you think about a search engine, you know, they say actually this benefits consumers, this deal between Apple and Google. I would argue that, you know, if you put another search engine and another search engine would have been the one that, you know, sort of rose to prominence over Google, there's not that much differentiation between Google and others. Google was a early, you know, trend preference for everyone. But it wasn't initially the, you know, search engine of choice for everyone. There was a lot of them. In fact, Google was just sort of like a newcomer at one point. And it's really around the time of smartphones that Google became sort of the default for everyone. And that's because partially it became the default for Safari. And so as you sort of learn about how they, you know, built this monopoly by being forward thinking. I mean, I think one of the things you can take away from this case is that Google was very, very innovative and had a good idea of the future and what it would look like. But because of that, because of their ingenuity, I think it makes it pretty obvious that, you know, these were not just slapdash, you know, risky decisions that they made. These were very calculated and thought through, you know, business moves that were cutthroat. And in many cases, you know, that trend has continued now that they've got sort of like the fence around their base. I don't know, producer Manny, does it strike you as sort of like nefarious that they would do these deals, you know, 15 years ago, you know, like on the verge of smartphones and things along those lines, that, you know, like, am I being hard? Am I discounting sort of the value of search engines by saying, like, if you were to replace Google with a different one, would it bother you? Would it bother most people, you think, very much?
From a personal standpoint, kind of. I feel like Google this is more of a recent situation. I mean, 15 years ago, that's a whole another story. Yeah. But now with Google, whenever you sign into any new software or any new product, they just have like sign in using your Google account.
Yeah,
I think that convenience just further, you know, enhances their dominance in the space. So if you were to give me something like Safari or Mozilla, and then that option isn't there, it reduces my convenience as a customer. So as of now, yeah, it would probably be something I'd be annoyed with if I had to go to a different search provider.
So that's always a debate in technology, because I think all users would agree that vertical integration is generally a better user experience. You think about, like, if you use Microsoft Office, it works great if you're using Outlook and Word and PowerPoint and all those things. But then if you're using Google Docs and PowerPoint and, you know, you've got a separate email system, it's like those things don't really work together real well. And it's not as seamless. It's a lot clunkier. It's a lot easier when everything is just like one, you know, one company suite, because they build it all together. It makes sense. But it gets a little bit different whenever it's like, you know, if you're talking about, you know, a work place software suite versus like both my digital finances, my digital browsing, my digital communication, my device that I carry around to access news and information. Because, you know, would you mention this, you know, sign in with Google, you know, the other companies that offer something like that are like, what, Apple, Facebook, other big tech companies that have this massive user base. And you can make the argument that, you know, that's another moat that Google has dug around their business, you know, at the expense of, you know, crushing competition early on. So, you know, that advantage that they have to, you know, grow a further advantage is only, you know, as a result of something that, you know, they did on purpose. And using that advantage to create an advantage elsewhere to make a business stronger, that is the definition of antitrust, depending on the application. So I'm very interested in this. I don't think that this is one of those Google, you know, is being, you know, sued by a government or a state stories that you can ignore, because I think this one is likely to have some sort of resolution that is, you know, disruptive.
Yeah, and keeping on that same topic, within that trial, it seems like Google is trying to keep secrets. The U.S.
They would never.
No, they would absolutely not. You know, only if it was important.
Yeah.
And not relevant to the case.
Yeah, and important to them. Got it.
Yeah, because the U.S. Justice Department is challenging Google's request to keep their online advertising pricing a secret during the antitrust trial. The government believes that this information is crucial to the case, arguing for transparency, and the trial's outcome could shape the tech industry, impacting giants like Amazon, Apple, and Facebook. So it's going to be very interesting to see what these advertising prices are, especially since Google is valued, I think, at like $1 trillion. So just to see where these pricings are coming from.
Yeah, so I have the unique position to be in to know exactly what information they want to protect and why. And I also know it's primarily focused on how much money that Google is taking out of the ecosystem. And because if you think about this, Google is the default browser on Safari, right? You pull up your mobile phone, you search something, boom, you land on a Google page, right? So that advantage that's been alleged in the antitrust case of using, you know, that's just one example of the Safari Apple deal. But so now you're using Google search engine. So they've sold search ads onto that page. So they're picking what results you see, and then they're allowing advertisers to run ads on it. They also have the platform for advertisers. So the only way to get listed on Google search results is through one of Google's platforms or intermediary tools. So they're making money off of the search engine ad, number one. Let's say you don't click on any of those. You go down, you click on a result, and then bam, you got display ads on that page. If you know the site wants to make any real money from display ads, they're going to be showing, almost universally, they're going to have to show programmatic ads from Google's ad exchange, in which they will have to then use Google's ad server, so their ad technology, to do so. And they'll also have to use, you know, Google demand, which is all those advertisers with Google. So now you've got Google selling the ads. Now they're also buying the ads, because the publisher, the person that's going to make the money from those ads, is also having to use the exact same ad server or a partner that has an ad server, and they're a child on that account. And so what's happening now is that Google has paid to be the default search engine where they're making money off ads and then selling and buying ads on the results. So they're double dipping there, the search results page and the website results themselves. And then whenever we're all said and done with all of that, what's happening is Google is taking money at each layer of that. And the question that Congress and the people of the United States, damn it, like the people that those people want to know exactly how much is being taken, when, where, and how, because one of the things that's alleged in this case is that Google would give preferential treatment, almost like mob boss, allegedly. But you have somebody like Amazon where maybe I'm thinking of Apple in this case, but nevertheless, there's some that are similar to this in the Google one, where it's alleged that different companies have been paying different prices outside of just the normal sort of like bidding and pricing discussions. And that's, I won't say one way or another whether that's true or not, but that there is a decent amount of like really important information related to the transparency of this, because I think Google provides a ton of value inside of the ecosystem. You mentioned the sign-in by Google thing. These sorts of vertical integrations do have value because you know how and when dollars are spent. But where's the value to anyone outside of Google if that information is completely hidden? And I think that they bring up a great point here where it's, if all of these things that you've done and decisions you've made benefit consumers and benefit everyone in the ecosystem, all parties equally, then we should be able to all see it. And if not, then you can keep it hidden, but we need to then break this apart, because it's unfair that you're the only one that knows exactly how much value is being added and provided.
Yeah, and keeping on the topic of Google keeping secrets here, we're going to move on to Google's controversial upcoming AI software. So Google's DeepMind division is crafting a groundbreaking AI system named Gemini. This system merges the prowess of AlphaGo with advanced language capabilities, aiming to revolutionize chatbots. And this is supposed to be taking multiple different types of data styles or data types like images. You're going to be able to input text. We're hoping that you're going to be input video as well. And with the potential applications in travel, work, and entertainment, Google's Gemini could be the next big leap in interactive AI, which is interesting because I feel like it was about a month ago that we were talking about how Google was also under trial for being anti-competitive with travel companies as well.
Yeah. The list of companies that feel that Google is anti-competitive is long. And, you know, we're hard on this show. There are a lot of people that work there, especially on some of the teams that we've even talked about on this, that I know personally. And They do really good work. The reason why we talk about them so much is primarily because, well, number one, they're completely like our industry has them in their system like a cancer. Again, negative connotation, but they're inseparable from our space. And the reason is because they are ingenious, because they were forward thinking and they've stayed so far ahead of everybody else for so long. But with that comes a lot of responsibility, and that responsibility is largely to, you know, the people that you're serving, which is, the majority of the population is interacting, with Google in some form or fashion, unless you live in a country where it's not available, like China. And, Gemini is, I think another great example of where I think Google just desperately wants to lead in AI. And I think for the longest time, they felt like they were so far ahead and that they could almost, they kind of drug their feet, not kind of, they did. And Gemini is another good example of where I think some of their more advanced AI systems that they've had, DeepMind, when they got bought and they've been resold since then. But Google bought DeepMind, which was a big deal. It was, I think they were based in their London office in UK, and probably 5-6 years ago, maybe even longer, the AI played and beat a human in Go, which is far more complicated, as far as I understand, than chess. That's what everybody says. I've never played Go before. Manny, ever played Go?
Nope, never played Go.
So, yeah, it's just many exponentially more moves that you can make and much more difficult and challenging. And, you know, the point of them releasing sort of those results back then was to highlight sort of the problem solving and, you know, like thinking or critical thinking capacity of, you know, some of the AI that they'd been working on. The problem that I have right now is it would be very hard to impress, not just me, but I think impress the world of, you know, data scientists and developers with some new model, because right now you take away ChatGPT, even there's a lot of open source, and then just the world of AI has exploded because it's exponential. You can use AI to create more AI to create these like hyper specific models. So if Gemini's, the idea there is that it's going to be the anything agent, meaning, you know, outside of just asking questions, you needed to, you know, make an appointment, you needed to generate an image, you needed to write a report, you needed to build a website. Like, it's going to have to be, I just don't see a short-term version of that that people are going to be impressed with or want to use. And because of that, I think that, you know, like, they're kind of wavering here, where it's, I can't make decisions for Google, but I do feel like, you know, their announcements on AI should be taken with a grain of salt until proven different.
We were just still very sore from the whole Bard situation from
a few months ago, right? It's a great example. It's like pretty hard not to imagine that this isn't, it's kind of like, we're like, hey, we got a better deal over at this car dealership. And they're like, wait, I'll give you a better price. And it's like, well, I actually still think this other one's a better deal. I like the car better. And they're like, well, wait, we got something else in the back I think you're really going to like, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, it kind of feels like at this point, you know, they've really got to prove themselves, I think, to people that their investments in AI over time have, you know, paid off, or, you know, offer something that others don't, because right now they're definitely not leading in this category.
No, definitely not. So hopefully they have a big ace up their sleeve. Luckily, they're not distracted or, you know, have their hands full with anything else.
They definitely prioritize this. It's just a matter of, you know, is it too little too late? I heard that they had lost one of their executives that was primarily in charge of making decisions as it relates to like safe AI policy and things like that. All the sort of like, you know, baggage that comes with that job and, you know, like the circumstances there aside. I do think that one of the things that she brought up in an interview recently that was somewhat critical was that, you know, Google at this point has kind of thrown a lot of their, you know, the protocols and programs that they had in place to sort of, you know, like I would say principles, I guess, around AI development out the window because they're behind. And that may very well be what they need to do to try to catch up, because I don't think that you're going to take a safety first approach and catch up from where they're at right now.
Correct, correct. It's never worked for me in Mario Kart. I don't think it's going to work here either.
Yeah, no, probably not. And yeah, I mean, speaking of just, you know, kind of like all the different things that have been going on in terms of, you know, organizational disruptions and things along those lines, you know, we've got TikTok was recently fined in the UK, I think. And but now they've launched something new in the US that, you know, they're going to give it a try that has never really caught on here. And yeah, what did TikTok just recently launch, Manny?
So TikTok recently unveiled its TikTok shop here in the US, blending commerce with content. This new feature introduces shoppable videos to its 150 million American users. Brands and creators can now sell directly from the platform, and users can explore products with ease. However, concerns about data privacy linger with TikTok, which TikTok is still addressing with its trusted third-party payment platform. This is kind of like Instagram Shop that recently launched. Personally, I have never used Instagram Shop, so maybe TikTok Shop is going to be kind of along the same lines, and it might not take off as before, but Gen Z is really big into TikTok. So yeah, they might be able to take this and soar with it.
So long-time listeners of the podcast will know that this is something we've talked about, honestly, for probably 5 years back when we were doing the show originally. And the reason why I mentioned this is because this is huge in China. It is some of their big tech monopolies are, this is an integral part. This idea of live shopping, like QVC, hover video stuff. And, you know, like if you're like listening to this and you're like QVC, like live shopping, you can go on to Amazon right now. And if you have the app on your phone, at least on an iOS, they have like a menu at the bottom where there's like a light bulb or something like that. But if you click on it, you'll see what looks to be like Instagram stories or Snapchat stories or reels or whatever you want to call it. But they're just sort of like story-based videos that you can click through that are influencers that are essentially like affiliate hawking products. And that is huge in China. Like I think, you know, somebody a couple years ago, they made almost $1 billion in a year. Their equivalency of like a Kim Kardashian through just sort of like selling live shopping stuff. So the way that it works there is you have people that are influencers and they're actually like live selling you stuff, like drops and stuff like that. It's never caught on here, and everybody has tried, everybody that has some kind of like platform to be able to like springboard into this. It doesn't seem to really mesh in the Western world the same way it does in parts of the Asian world. But I would say that, you know, one of the things that TikTok might have going for it is that it definitely is more sort of like formatted for it. I feel like it's been a little bit more of a square peg in a round hole with most of the other platforms, where it kind of feels like I'm not really here for this. But the biggest difference between here and China, here being the US, is that in China, many of the big tech monopolies have sort of even more integrated than they are here in the US, where you have things like the Everything app, where it's really kind of like Apple. If Apple also like owned Google and maybe Instagram or something like that, to where it's like all these, you're not even in a browser, you're just in one app and it does everything. It's almost like your operating system. And so I don't know that without that sort of like integration, which will never happen. I mean, we've been talking about Google's anti-competitive practices all day. And I think, I just don't imagine that, you know, maybe the appeal is there without sort of the sign in, you know, like you pull open your phone, you don't have to sign into anything. It's like just all right there. But yeah, we'll see. You plan on buying anything off of TikTok here soon?
So I'm one of those people that have still held out. I had TikTok on my phone for maybe like a day and a half before I was like, you know, this isn't for me. This is like a time funnel that is just going to take a lot of my time. So I tried to avoid it. So I probably won't be using it, but I will get some insights from my younger sister, who's a Gen Z-er. So she'll probably let me know if she's using it or not.
A Gen Z-er. Yeah. That's how I know whenever I'm like a Gen Z-er or something, like whenever I try to put myself in the shoes of someone and then reference them in this sort of like broad category, I'm always like, I'm the old person. I don't know what's going on here. So we'll see. I'm not an avid TikTok user at all. And so it is, you know, with social platforms that maybe I don't use, or I won't say don't understand. I get TikTok. And I think the thing that gives me pause on being able to make, a full qualification of my opinion on it is partially just based on the fact that I don't use it, don't understand the user base as well as I would something that I am using. And so there may be something there that I'm missing. And it very well could be something that, you know, they make work. We do have a couple stories on X, but I want to get into AI news here shortly. So maybe you can just summarize for us, Producer Manny, some of the stuff that's been happening at X. But it seems like they're pretty much just at odds with the government at every layer at this point, the U.S. government and the European one. So a lot of governments.
Yeah, so just to brush through this real quickly, the U.S. government is pushing for Elon Musk to testify in a probe concerning Twitter, now known as X. This investigation, which began before Musk's acquisition, has intensified due to the concerns about the platform's commitment to user privacy. And the government points out that Musk's rapid changes and the potential exposure of private data are key issues. And almost as a response to this, or maybe adjacent to this, X has also rolled out a new government ID-based verification for its paid users. This move is in collaboration with Israeli, I might butcher this, but AU10Tix, aims to curb impersonation and bolster platform security. However, due to its strict data protection laws, this feature is unavailable in the EU, in the EEA, and in the UK. And this also comes off of the heels of Israeli President Benjamin
Netanyahu,
who was in a conversation with Musk where he urged him to do something about all the anti-Semitism on X.
Yeah, and I think, it's a classic case we've talked about on the show before, and I don't want to make it seem like I'm inserting political opinions or anything along those lines, but it is one of the things I am quite critical of, and not just Western governments around the world, none are unique in this respect, but most attempts that they've had to try to regulate technocrats or big technology companies have largely empowered those same entities or parties. Before you put any conspiracy hats on and think that, this is something they've worked together on, I would say that these are all, good attempts or well-intentioned attempts to try to actually remove some of the, power that these entities hold over both the societies and the municipalities themselves. Because I think you can look at something like GDPR, where it was very clear that the goal of it was to fine Facebook and Google and Apple. But what it does is it draws these lines of like, here are the rules of the game. It's the same thing with the U.S. government trying to regulate cryptocurrency better as a security, the SEC is. And one of the things that those exchanges have argued is that they don't have any well-written regulations to work within currently. So if they get fined, it's arbitrary. And it's kind of the same way with these tech companies, which is when the government comes along and finds a problem, they draw the lines before they understand the problem, and it's almost impossible to draw the lines without, we've talked about it before on the show, but it's very, very difficult to get a small form of regulation on this correct without creating like unintended consequences. But this is an even greater example where it's like, you want us to protect data privacy. Okay, well, we need to know your identity. So now every single person is required by law to give us a government ID or something like that, where it's like, well, now you've actually forced me to give them more data that could be compromised. And now, you've given this, tech company a license to get my license, if you will. And, that makes them more powerful, because if you start having to interact with more things online with a verified identity, the sign in with Google thing, it's like, if X is the thing that you've already given your identity to, how many big tech companies do you want to give it to? So maybe you just use one, and that gives them a stronger grip or a stronger hold on another part of the space. And it comes from, you know, trying to do something that, you know, holds them accountable. But in reality, you know, if they get to basically formulate how they would, you know, go about implementation, it doesn't do anything but give them an advantage. So this is something that I think is persistent in publishing, and it hasn't gone away. And I don't imagine it will soon, because I think, you know, at all, most consumers believe that big tech companies have, you know, too much sort of like sway and authority over their personal lives, and would like to do something about that. And then that sort of tears down to, you know, government sentiment. And, you know, in politics, it's oftentimes not about what you do, it's about how you do it. And yeah, unfortunately, I'm not very optimistic about that, about government regulation coming to our rescue in that regard. Not because of anything other than just it's, you know, historically not been proven to be all that effective. But maybe they'll get it right when it comes to AI, as we transition into AI news, where it's a slightly different, because it's more than just world governments. It's kind of all the players, you know, all the players of the game got together recently at the AI Insight Forum, and they were exploring AI regulation. So producer Manny, what was the big takeaway from this?
So yeah, there was a big closed door meeting between politicians, civil society leaders, and then tech giant leaders, being that like Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg, Bill Gates, Sam Altman, etc. They all expressed different concerns regarding AI regulations. With representations from each company, there was a unanimous call for government-led AI regulation. Elon Musk championed the idea of a regulatory referee for AI, to have someone just kind of like lead the charge and be bipartisan and be like, hey, we should maybe focus on different aspects of regulation to make sure that we look out for everyone else.
Yeah. And I know that a lot of the, a lot of the, what you hear out of Silicon Valley is that no matter it, there's going to be no universal agreement on what, a broad form of regulatory like oversight on AI is. So you can kind of look at this in the same way you could look at something like genetic engineering, where it's like the US or Canada or whoever can put as many regulatory laws and stuff in place as they want. But if in another country, these things are not prohibited, then you're going to, and there's, you know, value there. What you're going to see is you're going to see all the scientists go there and start to pursue that, or at least, you know, progress being made in that field, whether it's ethical or not, in a country where, you know, it's allowed. And I see AI being no different. Even if you just bought a private island and you were a billionaire with, you know, and hired a bunch of data scientists outside of the, you know, watchful eye of a world government, if the idea here is to prevent sort of like malicious AI from, you know, providing something that is harmful to society, to me, that seems impossible. It's more about sort of like the, well, for our space, it's intellectual property, right? Like who's the owner and the originator of content and information. But then aside from that, when you look at sort of like the applications of AI, then it's about like, okay, so how would we draw like a guardrail for sort of where something is applied and what its limits are? So if AI is driving a car, you wouldn't necessarily want that same AI to be the one that's like, you know, interacting with your bank account, or, you know, maybe interacting with your, you know, appointments or calendar or something like that, because that seems far reaching. And it seems like, you know, there's a lot of area there for someone or whoever's, you know, the originator of that AI to, you know, potentially take advantage or, you know, gain a significant amount of power. So I think that that is probably an area where world governments can do something, is sort of like draw these very distinct sort of barriers between where AI bleeds into one thing from another. That's a lesson we can learn from, you know, the early days of the internet. I have seen a little bit about like an AI tax, And I find that quite interesting, especially in instances where I don't imagine in any time soon that AI will be completely autonomous in any field, meaning there no human is involved. In fact, there may be more humans that need to be involved. But as that sort of happens, I do think that some of those human jobs may be lower skill than, you know, the ones that occupy them currently. And because of that, I think, you know, an AI tax that sort of like redistributes sort of like the production from machines, which assumably would go to, you know, like whoever's developed them, so that it actually does end up into the hands of citizens as opposed to, you know, making a corporate entity wealthier. I do think that that's an interesting idea, and one that's probably worth exploring or something along those lines. I don't know. Was there any takeaways from what you read on this, Producer Manny, that stuck out to you as interesting or optimistic?
Yeah, actually, I have some notes here from each person that was at that closed door meeting, and you can kind of see the variety of different thoughts that they have regarding AI. You mentioned that the new tax system, so that was proposed by Sam Altman, the CEO of AI, OpenAI. And his goal is to redistribute the wealth created by AI, whereas Mark Zuckerberg promotes that he wants AI to be an open source approach development so that all AI models are widely available to everybody. Elon Musk is warning everyone of the existential threat and risk of AI. Deborah Raji, who is a computer scientist from Canada, was concerned about addressing biases within AI systems, and it holds developers accountable for the harm caused by those biases. Union leader Meredith Steinem is addressing that they don't want AI to replace workers and to somehow input some sort of safeguard to help prevent people from losing their jobs due to AI. And then you have the CEO of Google, who's addressing that they want, that they're like opposing to having that referee concept that Elon yeah. Musk had proposed. And he wants just that the existing agencies that oversee AI continue to just regulate them.
Yeah, and I really dislike all ideas in this category. The union leader and the person that mentioned, I think it's Raji that you mentioned, that talked about like holding developers accountable. It's like saying you want to hold Google accountable for somebody that learns how to build a bomb on Google. I think that that's unreasonable, and it stifles innovation and growth. Same thing in terms of, you know, you want to artificially tell someone that they have to do a job that doesn't need to be done that a machine could do, because we want to get stuck into, you know, the world would never progress if we basically just regulated away all things that are more efficient. If we would have said, hey, no, humans have to, humans have to actually dig all coal out of the ground with their bare hands. They can't use machines or dig holes. We'd have a lot more coal, like mining jobs, but my God, like, yeah, the amount of harm done to those people that would have to work those jobs is mind blowing. So I think that we've got to move away from sort of thinking about things the way that they are now and sort of imagine that these things have already happened, and then figure out what systems and measures we can take to A, prevent, you know, the rise of, you know, megalithic, monolithic, you know, technology corporations that are able to take advantage of that or use that influence to impact society in an unfair or negative way. And then I also think that we need to figure out how do we redistribute sort of like the value that is generated from this. So, you know, imagine that AI takes every white collar job.
Gasp.
Now that you have your breath back, thanks, Producer Manny. I appreciate the sound effects. And the big thing that I think about with this is that, you know, the amount of money that you know, the average household income across the globe has been rising in a linear fashion. You could say the same thing for, you know, the amount of revenue that's generated and then also paid out to people. And that's why GDP is an important thing. So if you look at, you know, something that all of our listeners are familiar with, ad rates, it's very proportional to gross national products. If you look at the US in particular, it's like as ad rates go up, GDP is there. Same, and that's why birth rates are really important, is because that's why you're hearing countries like China and the US start talking about declining birth rates. Same thing with Japan. Because the number of people you've been able to have inside of your country is for the longest time been very closely associated or correlated with your gross national product, the amount of money that your country can produce. And with AI, seemingly, if it can do every white collar job, that value, the GDP that we're producing is still there. And assumingly, probably more. So you have this rise in GDP. So that doesn't mean that the money goes nowhere. The money is still there. The question is how is that wealth that's generated from that, you know, assimilated into, you know, the country itself, the people. And I think that the government could play a really important role in that, if nothing else, in sort of like determining what is sort of fair and what is not, because, you know, the money that is being generated has to come from somewhere. Usually right now, if you look at it, it's coming from the citizens. It's in the best interest of corporations to have customers. And if your customers are all poor because you have all the money, then that doesn't really work. So there is a nuance here that I think a lot of people have missed when it comes to thinking about AI replacing humans. I think we should welcome it replacing us and doing anything that we don't love to do. And I, you know, there's a lot of jobs out there I would argue that people don't love to do. So hopefully all of you that are listening are, I know a lot of you are digital publishers, and this is your dream to be publishing content to the web. And I do think that that is one job that only a human can do. While the aspects and components of the job are, you know, maybe something that a machine can do, or maybe, you know, repetitive or redundant, you know, the unique sort of like perspectives and, you know, the very human element of content itself, I think is something that actually is going to be one of the last things that could ever be replaced. And for that reason, I'm very optimistic about both the future of our industry and everyone here listening. If you're listening to the show, you're way ahead of the curve because you're on top of and probably have a healthy amount of respect for the concerns and the sort of like innovation disruption that's occurring. So I would say don't lose any sleep over sort of, you know, the scarier aspects of what's going on. I think if anything, you know, you should be, you know, aware yet excited, because I think that this is a time where there's going to be a lot of opportunity. There generally is whenever there's a lot of disruption, but only the future will tell. And if you have questions that pertain to any of the topics we talked about today or any of the subjects that we talked about on the show in general, you can go to publisherlab.org, publisherlab.org. And if there's anything that you would like us to talk about or questions that you have, put them in there. We'll talk about them. And then you can listen to it on podcast platforms everywhere. You can watch us on YouTube if you've never watched the show and want to see what producer Manny looks like in person. He's 9 feet tall and blue, and you can see that if you watch on YouTube. If not, you'll just have to take my word for it. And I will do a kick check for the first time in a couple weeks. So these are the Nike Jordan 1 Korea Days, and these were very coveted by your favorite podcast host. And finally was able to get a pair. And so I'm very, very excited about these. And yeah, I broke them out for the podcast for the first time today. So shout out to the one person, hopefully you're still listening, that enjoys the sneakers. And that's it. And we'll catch you next time on the Publisher Lab.